Welcome back to the Bastionland podcast, where we'll be caving to public demand and returning to the rule of three format. Each week, I'll talk with a new guest about three tabletop games that are important to them. I'm Chris McDowell, and today I'm joined by former video game journalist, former board game reviewer, former card game champion, and now he's finally hit the bottom of the barrel by moving on to RPGs. It's the star of Quinn's Quest, Quinton Smith. Hello, Quinn.
Hello, Chris. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm covering RPGs for a living now, which makes me, I don't know, I feel like an animal that's gone from battery farming to free range. I'm just living in the world of imagination and stories now. It's nice. It's good.
We touched on this slightly before we started, and I feel like I'm not going to go too deep onto this because I feel like there's an entire podcast on how are RPGs different to board games. But how are you finding things so far coming from the board game, I'm doing inverted commas, community to the to the RPG community?
I mean, the board game business. No, you know, I thought it would, this is a funny thing to say, but I thought it would be meaner. Because when I was in board games, my exposure to the RPG community was mostly like Twitter discourse. And
I know.
And so when I got into RPGs, I was really surprised that by and large, whenever I spoke to everybody, everybody was quite friendly in person. Or, you know, when I actually reached out to them over DMs or whatever, everyone's been very nice. Everyone's been very welcoming. I've also been surprised by the fact that because the TTRPG community is smaller, and like that's where I feel like I've got and more exciting work to be done, honestly, because if a board game is going to sell 20,000 copies and I help it to sell 30,000 copies, that's fine. That's good. It's cool. I'm very privileged to have that power. But if a RPG is going to sell 4,000 copies and I help it to sell 10,000, then, which I don't know, like I'm pulling these figures out of my ass, but that feels like a much more rewarding way to spend my time.
Yeah, that doesn't sound a million miles away from what I've heard of the stories.
The inaugural Quinn's Quest coverage. Yeah, well, look, I'm just happy to be here. It feels like a really good time to be working in RPGs because, you know, peeling people away from the monolith that is D&D. Like, I've never in my career as an entertainment journalist ever encountered a field which has a single IP in the room, like, slurping so much, like, of the oxygen out the air. And, like, I like D&D, you know, I like Dungeons and Dragons. I like both of those things. But like, I more than either of those things, I like, you know, talented designers doing experimental stuff. And D&D simply makes it harder for those people to do it for a living.
Yeah, it's funny that not even Monopoly has as big a monopoly as D&D.
Did you have that ready?
I did not. That's just that's the kind of quality you get on this podcast.
We were saying off the top of the dome.
Straight off the top of the dome. So without giving away any of your choices, what was your kind of process for choosing three important games to talk about today? Important to you, I should say.
You know, Chris, honestly, it was these games are all in some respect important to me. But more than that, they were games I wanted to talk about with you on this podcast. And yeah, I don't know, stuff that is adjacent to tabletop. I think it's stuff that I'm passionate about right now. And the thing is that, like, I'm sure lots of your other guests can come in and be like, you know, I was just listening to the Alan Girding one. It's like, I like HeroQuest. And it's like, I'm sure you do. The problem with my brain is I get really distracted. And so, like, this is what I'm excited about right now.
Yeah, it was a very deliberate choice when I did this format that it was going to be three games that are important to you, not your three best games of all time, because I think that's like that's a cruel format.
Yeah,
to foist upon anyone
every time, especially when you're going to record it for all time in a podcast. Yeah, anytime anyone asks me like, "Oh, you work in board games? What's your favorite game?" It's like when you ask a computer to do a scan of its entire hard drive. I just go silent for like, you know, minutes, and then I say something bad, like I don't know.
Well, without further ado, let's get on to your first choice. So, what game have you chosen for your first choice?
Oh, wow. Are you letting me choose which one comes first?
You can choose. I have the order that you gave them to me, but that doesn't have to be the order.
Oh, okay. I was going to talk about the one role-playing... Well, the one Western role-playing game on the list first.
Oh. Yeah, go for it. So what was that one?
I want to talk about Torchbearer because I've actually only played what I believe is the first edition.
I don't think the editions are that different. So I think it's one of these ones where we can probably apply it to both.
Okay, well, I wanted to talk about Torchbearer because I, you know, being on a podcast with a luminary, you know, like dungeon thinker such as yourself, I know how I feel about many different areas of the TTRPG space. I'm still figuring out how I feel about dungeons, because they are such an insane concept. Like how has the concept of a hole in the ground full of monsters absorbed so much of the TTRPG's like imagination and attention? Sure. And I think so Torchbearer is the closest thing to a dungeon delving game that has captured my interest and heart. And I wanted to express to your listeners why. Because I have the peculiar interest that if we are going into a dungeon, it needs to be really focused on the physicality of that. And what I really like about Torchbearer is that it is the dungeon delving game that, to my like very limited experience, makes you feel the most like you are fully spelunking. Like, it is a game that wants you to feel like everything on your back is so heavy. It's a game that wants you to be cold and tired and wet and scared. The dungeons are not designed for you to, I don't know, like go down and get to the bottom and get the treasure. The players are constantly in this discussion with themselves of like, when do we turn around because we're going to die? And I think like, I guess just to round off that point, like, yeah, if we're gonna role play going into a hole in the ground, it needs to be connected to what spelunking is for human beings who do it in real life, which is essentially an extreme sport where you cut yourself on rocks a lot.
This is it. I love dungeons in games, but I don't have many like phobias. In fact, I don't know if I have any phobias in this world other than going into an actual cave.
Interesting. So have you tried to bring any of that phobia into the dungeons you design or roleplay?
No, I think I don't confront it at all by making my dungeons stupid fun houses. Like you're watching Nightmare. Like, that's my vibe of dungeon.
Yeah,
like,
and that
what's in this weird room?
It's like a goblin that's trapped in a jelly, and you know, then what's the goblin going to say when you get it out of the jelly?
Yeah, it's almost like two. You almost can't compare the two, because like the actual reality, like you say, of going into a cave would be going into a cave is horrible anyway, even in our world where there's not monsters.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Like it's already so bad.
Yeah, it's peculiar. I guess for me, role-playing is often about, like, you know, trying to connect to some element of the human experience. I'm realizing that, like, after a couple of months of launching Quinn's Quest, I've been made really aware of where my view differs from a lot of members of the board game, of the TTRPG community. God, old habits die hard, me saying board games just then. That... especially within the OSR scene, people are really interested in puzzles and creative solutions. And I think I'm not necessarily interested in stories per se, but I'm interested in emotions and feelings and humanity.
Yes.
And I think it's thrown me to realize how many people, when they're playing a TTRPG, want to sit down and kind of have this, you know, like you say, a goofy funhouse experience. And I'm not saying I don't want to do that. I'm really excited to run the estate for Mouse Ritter at some point in the near future. I'm having a great time running Mothership, but always with my GMing, like there's an element of me that wants to get a little closer to, I don't know, what it is to be human, like prestige TV, or, you know, dare I fucking say it, literature. Like those are what I choose to absorb in my free time, and that's then what my GMing gets drawn towards.
Yeah, and it's difficult with one of the big differences, I guess, with RPGs and board games is, with RPGs, there is that difficulty of trying to make sure everyone's on the same page at the table. Yeah. Like, we could sit down to play, let's say D&D, just as I hate to use it as an example, but if we both sit down to play D&D, I might be thinking, oh, I want to make this all about problem solving and like exploring this idea of like tactical infinity, where it's like, well, you can try anything and you can come up with all these creative solutions. You might be thinking that you want a really gritty rules experience. The third person at table might want that emotional storytelling thing. And it's really hard. So the thing that leaps out to me about Torchbearer and games like this is I think they do a good job of kind of getting people on that same page quite early on. The fact that it literally has that rule that's called the grind tells you a lot. So I think that the fact that your characters have got like things like your belief on there, and you've got like sort of other types of traits and things that kind of talk about your character's feelings, even if the thing that I like about it is I can look at that game and I think 9 times out of 10, that's not especially the kind of game that's going to grab me. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a feature, because it means that if the 1 time out of 10 that I might think, you know what, I do want to play this game, I'm going into it with the right frame of mind and the right kind of attitude.
Yes, exactly.
Rather than trying to make it fit what I'm after.
Precisely. I remember, I don't know, this is a, when I was doing the, when D&D 5th edition had just came out and I was running the starter set for a feature on Shut Up and Sit Down, we just finished like the first encounter where some goblins attack a caravan, classic. And then we got to the town and it was the first town in the starter set. And three of my players were really excited to just gad about and go to the inn and get drunk and talk to NPCs. And the fourth player had a look on his face like he was bored out of his mind. And immediately as a GM, I went, I'm screwed. There's no way to square the circle because, and then when we got into combat, three of the players were really interested and the fourth player was really bored. And it's like, okay, Torchbearer. Yeah, no, you're right. The, you know, the content aim theme of Torchbearer is so on its sleeve. Like it starts with the question of who really would go into a dungeon if there's a skeleton in there that wants to kill you? And the answer is like desperate people.
Yes.
And it really returns to like, it doesn't need to contrive, oh, if you get gold, that's how you level up, for example, if, in a system where gold equals experience points. No, it's like you need to get find something to sell to eat. And I also just love that rather than hit points, it has the like condition system where, which, you know, so before you die, you will become tired. And before you die, you will become interestingly afraid. Like you might be afraid because, you know, some banshee did a scream and now you're afraid, but you might be afraid because, and I just love this as storytelling, you're fighting that skeleton that wants to kill you and it hits you. And you have that moment where you have to mark afraid because you realize, oh, I'm outclassed and I'm about to be stabbed to death.
Yeah. Like,
it really, I think we, honestly, we're getting further away from what I really wanted to talk about that you so eloquently described, which is like going into a cave is absolutely horrific in real life. And at its simplest, I think I care about Torchbearer for trying to bring some of that to a dungeon. I mean, it's in the title, right?
Yeah.
When was the last time you played a dungeon where it felt dark?
Absolutely. And I think this is it. Like, I mean, I saw you mention Veins of the Earth.
Oh, yeah.
That you have that book. That's one that does go into that, but it's a very particular vibe. But I think, like you said, it's so many dungeons are like they try and be scary. Like, I guess like the Tomb of Horrors is like a big example of like, oh, this is scary. Well, kind of. And you know, there's lots of dungeons that have undead and monsters that should feel scary.
Correct,
but they are somehow less scary than just the reality of it being dark.
Yeah, I played my Torchbearer campaign like 7 years ago, so I've forgotten a lot of it, but it is coming back to me now. I think what I really liked in Torchbearer was, you know, when you have these really engaging rules for climbing and darkness, and like, I don't know, one of the first caves my players ever went into, it's like, okay, there's a sheer drop here, and water is running down the walls, so you need to climb into darkness for 40 feet down a wet wall. And that, for the players, was more tense and frightening than, you know, your average encounter in a dungeon with, you know, like 2d4 goblins or whatever. But then, Chris, what happens is one of them abseils down to the bottom, I'll go first, and then there is like a single spider, like a giant spider down there. And so it's not that Torchbearer, you know, says, oh, we'll just do spelunking and then that'll be our dungeon. It's like, no, it just brings in the energy of spelunking to the point that encountering two kobolds down in the dark is the worst thing that has ever happened to you. And
yeah,
I love that that attitude of dungeon design. I love it for having the like wherewithal to look at dungeons and be like, yeah, okay, we all like dungeons. Why don't we use even a fraction of what is scary to humans about going under the ground in real life?
And I'm always interested with horror games. And I think that there's been lots of discussion around this about like, can horror games truly ever be scary in, horror RPGs, I should say, in the way that a horror video game can be or a horror film can be. And I think it's a different kind of scary because by the nature of it, you are, in my experience, whenever you explore those, you do get those little moments of levity where people almost want to break the tension making a little joke or something, but the fear is still there. And it's a really interesting kind of tension that you don't really get with the kind of full immersion of like watching an absolute horrifying film in silence in the dark and just being gripped by fear the whole time. You've got that kind of little roller coaster, which I think is quite fun.
There's a really good tip in the Mothership Warden's Manual, right, about how to make your game scary. And one of the things that they encourage you to do is to use in your descriptors as a GM, talk about smell and talk about touch and talk about taste, because when you do that, you situate your players in their body. Like if you say, okay, you know, you touch the alien, like you can touch the alien corpse and it feels like this under your fingers. It feels like, you know, a wet dance mat or something, like plasticky and crinkly. Suddenly they're imagining their body. And once they're imagining their body, then when you describe, you know, their hand getting melted off, then that's a much more alarming thing that happens. And I think that's what Torchbearer gets out of really engaging with the act of spelunking. Because yes, it's always great to imagine, you know, like what touch and smell is like, and you should totally do that if you're running Torchbearer. But when you are describing, like, I don't know, a really narrow passage that humans have to squeeze through, or like disappearing under the water in a subterranean lake to pop up at the other side, and hopefully there's not a monster, but it will be pitch dark on the other side. Like, I think that's something that situates people in their bodies as well.
Yeah, and just those statuses, a lot of them are quite sort of grounded. So there's like, hungry is one of them, right?
Hungry.
Like, we've all been hungry. I'm kind of hungry right now. we've all been afraid. We've all been angry. But hopefully fewer of us have been like slashed by a sword. So like if you say, oh, the kobold slashes you with its sword and you've got a big wound, like I don't really know how to feel that.
Yeah, I you know, I found this when I was running Mothership, is that when I was running another bug hunt, when my players were just walking around a spooky base on a planet and they were alone and they didn't have radio contact with their superiors anymore, they knew how to feel. And then the moment, like, you know, in session two, a bug slashed some of their toes off and they were bleeding and irradiated, suddenly they were less in their body because that was too much.
Yeah.
Like they could imagine being wet, but they couldn't imagine losing a foot.
And we then, need like, more like stubbed toes and paper cuts and like relatable.
I think so. But I think like what Torchbearer does do is like, yeah, the kobold slashes at you and it's not, you know, it cuts through your chest and you lose 7 hit points. It's like it slashes at you. You manage to fend off the blow, but now you are breathing heavily and you don't think you can do that for much longer. Mark tired.
Yeah.
That feels really plausible. I've got a question for you, Chris. As I talk about like I wanted to talk about Torchbearer today because I wanted to express the game that has made me the most excited about Dungeons.
Mm.
When I'm talking about this and I'm expressing that I'm a little less able than most people to enjoy, you know, like funhouse dungeon design of something that's really lighthearted and full of puzzles and intriguing and creative, does that to you make me sound like a curmudgeon?
No, I think they are. The more I sort of look at this over the years, the more I think I don't mean for this to sound like divisive, but I think there are sort of quite distinct styles of play within RPGs.
Absolutely.
That you can combine and you can operate on the kind of gray areas between the two. But I think at the sort of, I don't know, this isn't the spectrum, but one of the spectrums is, I think, like we just talked about, the kind of problem solving, almost wargamey kind of thing of like, yeah, well, what should I do? How can I win? Which sounds very against the idea of what RPGs are. But like, I do like the idea of the dungeon as kind of a challenge and you're trying to get through it, almost like an escape room. I know that's not a perfect comparison. No,
that's how Sean McCoy describes Mothership modules.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not to say it's completely devoid of emotion, but I think that is a different style of play to the style of play of really getting into your characters and how they feel and why they're doing what they're doing, and almost the more literary approach of like, the point of the game is going to end up with a character that's kind of been through something and come out with a kind of arc. And I think
you
can try and do both at the same time, but I think games work really well when they focus on a more narrower window. So with like Into the Odd, for instance, I wanted to make it very much focused on the rules getting out of the way and just dealing with the sort of the exploring of a dungeon and what do you want to do. Is I wanted to get to that question of like, you're in this room, what do you do, as quickly as possible. But something like Torchbearer, even though it's different to the way I would design it, I do think that it's seems like it does a very good job of the style of play that it's trying to do.
Yeah, I think it even might be, maybe the reason I connect with it is I do think, kind of like Blades in the Dark, it's trying to do both. And it's not, I don't think it's an unsuccessful version of trying to do both, because it wants to situate you and your characters and their motivations, but it also then wants you to engage with a bit of, I mean, the tactics might be limited to like, we can't go any deeper into this cave, let's turn around, we're going to die. And or like, you know, you lose your rope and you need to find a new way up to the surface. Or you're hungry and you need to find something down there under the ground to eat, like you're playing Delicious in Dungeon. But yeah, no, this friction you're talking about is something I've been thinking about a lot. Like when I was running Mothership recently, or I'm running Delta Green at the minute, I'm running the Impossible Landscapes giant adventure. And something my player said to me is like, we do love the problem solving in this. Don't get us wrong, Mr. Games Master. But we have no idea. Well, it's not that they didn't know who their characters were. Individually, they all knew who their characters were. But they had so little opportunity to role play scenes with each other.
Yeah.
Because there was so much investigation to get through. And similarly with Mothership, it's like, you know, you have to do this. There's aliens coming. You have to survive. And they were like, okay, we got to survive. But we, after like three sessions, they'd be like, we're still trying to survive. And we don't know who we are. Like, they knew they had a cool trinket and they had a rough idea for their character, but they were never given room to breathe and do scenes with each other. And I think that's on me as a GM, but it feels like a lot of things in the TTRPG community, most notably Daggerheart recently, as everyone's been talking about, are trying to figure out how to do story gaming plus problem solving crunch.
Yes.
And it's just really hard. And I think in hindsight, it only makes me respect Blades in the Dark more for coming out as this fully formed thing. I mean, people can feel differently about it, but I do think it's a very successful early, inexplicably early example of fusing crunch and procedure with narrative fiction focused play.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I won't do my review of Blades in the Dark, but I've got a lot of respect for Blades in the Dark and I've had a lot of fun playing it. I think I get what you're saying. And I think that perhaps the reason why it works in something like Blades in the Dark or Torchbearer, but not so much in other games, is it would be easy to look at a version of Torchbearer where you do the grind and it's all very mechanical, and then you sort of say, right, now we're going to stop and your characters are going to talk for half an hour to each other around the campfire, and then you go back into the crunchy gamey thing. But it feels like it's more integrated here, like those moments are kind of coming up as part of the grind and as part of the dungeon exploration, and through the sort of the main type of gameplay in the game, you're getting those story moments in there organically. Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, it's totally right. This is why it's important, I think, that Blades, you don't take damage. You can get injured, you can lose a finger or whatever, but you can mostly get stressed. And in Torchbearer, you mostly get hungry. And if you think about like Heart or Spire, you know, the resistance games from Roanoke and Deckard, in those games, when you get extremely injured, you might get injured to your bank account and then or like injured to your luck, and then and then that actually generates a plot related scene for players to bounce off.
Well, we could probably go around on this one all day, but I think
Chris, if we keep talking about this, we're going to solve the most intractable problem at the heart of TTRPGs.
But then I'll be out of a job. Like if everyone knows how to make good games, what am I going to do?
That's a good point. Okay, no, let's save your career.
let's move on to your second, unless you had any closing thoughts on Torchbearer.
I just think making players squeeze through wet cracks is awesome, and they should all have to suffer it if they want to go into dungeons and have fun.
Wet cracks, there you go. Your second choice of game, what have you gone for?
Oh, goodness. Let's save the spicy one for last. And let's have a quick conversation about Sidereal Confluence.
Yes.
So this is a board game that people might not have heard of. It's the most niche thing ever. Sidereal Confluence, a Sidereal, a word you will definitely have to look up in the dictionary, is a board game for up to, I want to say, 7 players or potentially 9. Let's check on board game. Yeah, it goes up to 9, but...
Does it, though?
The all-important Board Game Geek rating of what the community says it plays. The community say it's best at 5 to 6. I think you could play it with 3 to 6 and have a good time. Sidereal Confluence came up quite late in my board game career. It was released in 2017, and I think it was a sign that eventually I would want to move to tabletop RPGs because, you know, we were just having this conversation about, like, you know, the weird dichotomy at the heart of tabletop role-playing game, that it's like, it's narrative and literary and feelingsy, and then it's also this like crunchy thing with wargaming roots and it's tactical problem solving. Sidereal Confluence is the same weird dichotomy, but it exists in board games, right? So what this game is, you've got 6 players around the table. Thematically, you all represent different alien races. There's no war. It's just like a kind of Star Trek like utopia where all these alien races meet and you're all going to trade and you're all going to get rich over centuries and you're all going to develop crazy technologies. And then you're going to, by the end of the game, you know, be the masters of reality itself. How this works in practice is it's a trading game. So it is the most off the chain, ambitious, like absurdly vast and like trading game of all time. But also, and this might be familiar to you from being in the TTRPG community, the game is just a conversation. So what it is the game starts and you all have little cards in front of you. Like maybe you're playing this weird lizard species that, you know, is very populous and you can collect more planets. Your planets generate little cubes of like seven different colors that might represent like biomass or nanotechnology or whatever. And then everybody has these technologies which are like converters, they're called. So maybe your weird little messed up lizard people can turn two biomass into four alloys, which is a great, like, you're turning not much into much more. Everyone's converter can only be run once in every round, right? So the game of Sidereal Confluence is every player has a bunch of cubes in front of them. Every player has a bunch of converters they want to run. Every player has planets they want to claim and technologies they want to research. And then you just go, and it becomes a stock exchange floor. You go, I've got alloys. Does anybody need alloys? You know, and this is why people say it's like really good with like up to six players, is that it's just carnage. Like, and the trading round only ends when players are done, but players are generally done when, but trading will lock up when like you've got usually three or four players who are happy and they've given away all the cubes they want to, and then one, two, three players who have cubes left, but none of their cubes are desirable anymore.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I'll add is every alien has like really peculiar features, some really crazy sci-fi concept in there. But one of them is this like ostensibly ostensibly altruistic species of space whales who have really good converters but can't use them themselves. So they have to sell cubes but also give their converters to people. And what this works like in practice is they're basically selling galactic gym memberships. You go, oh, no, definitely, just give me some cubes and I'll give you this great converter. You'll use it every round. It'll be great. And then you go, okay. And then it's sat in front of you for the entire game. And you're like, I never should have bought this. This was a disaster.
Well, I remember when this came out. And as soon as I heard the concept, I thought, this is going to be like my favorite game ever. I want to pick this up and I'm going to get this. It's going to be amazing. And then I started to look at like what the table looks like. When it's got everything laid out, and I thought, I don't know if I can get four or five people who are going to necessarily
going to tolerate this.
Yeah, and I think I still could, and I actually dodged a bullet with this, because you told me about this choice, I think towards the end of last week when we were chatting. You said that this was going to be your choice, and I thought, this could be it. I could now buy this as a
should have done
justify,
it.
I could say this is for work, and I need
you could
to
totally
this game.
You could totally play it with just like two, maybe three other people as well.
Yeah. Well, I had a group coming round last night for an RPG session, and I thought I could say, listen, I need you all to help me out with this work project. So we're all going to play Sidereal Confluence. And then I bottled it at the last minute, but I might still pick it up because I think, like you've said, it sounds like it does something really special. I love that idea of the freeform trading back and forth and the asymmetry between factions.
Yeah.
Like you said, that's what kind of almost makes it, so you've got the sort of the RPG elements of we're all traders, but also I think you probably can't help but act a little bit like your species that you've got. Like if your sheet is telling you that your species are like the sleazy, like slimy, what are the, who are those ones?
There's a, I want to say
like Zeth or something.
I was going to say Zezeth, but that's the name of a player from my Wild Sea campaign. Yeah, the Zeth Anocracy are basically thieves. It's like their racial trait is that they steal. Yes.
And I feel like people would not trust you immediately. If you say, yeah, my aliens are like the sleazy thieves, even if you don't act that way, it kind of, it enters the table as a factor, even though it's not necessarily.
I've always been interested in this in board games. And what you're describing definitely happens in another board game I quite like called Twilight Imperium, yes. Which is like the famous, you know, 4X all day game where you play different species and run around getting into trouble. And that has really fun. Like, but all of these games like Sidereal and Twilight Imperium, I find interesting for, you know, I guess actually, it's an area that board games have maybe explored fractionally more than TTRPGs, because TTRPGs will give you like a character class and then powers related to that character class. And as you use those powers, people can choose how they think about you. Mm. Board games have done, I think because they're competitive, there is some really nice design related to the fact that when you say what you are and players know what you can do theoretically, they immediately start treating you differently. I'm thinking here about there's a race in Twilight Imperium, which is the Necrovirus, which is a horrific Terminator-like race. It's not even like, oh, we reproduce. No, it's like they're just a virus. And rather than researching technology, the Necrovirus, if it destroys a unit in combat, can just take or like duplicate the technology that's in whatever they just ate. And what's great about this, and I would love to see this a bit more in the RPG community, is like, if you are sat next to the Necrovirus in a game of TI, immediately turn one, session one, you're like, we need an alliance against this motherfucker. Like, we simply can't, they're going to attack me. Yeah, and you get like that, you know, what's, you know, the fable of the scorpion and the frog.
Sure.
The fox. Like, you know, you'll be sat next to the Necrovirus saying like, don't attack me. And they're like, don't think I'm going to attack you just because I'm the Necrovirus. And then sure enough, turn two, they attack you. And it's like, yeah, no, what else was I going to do? I don't know. I think it would be really fun if TTRPGs were to explore more radical asymmetry in the way that in the way that tabletop games do. Like,
yeah. And the one that leaps to mind for me is Cosmic Encounter.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which is, I remember a game of that where I had, I think it was called The Mind or The Brain was my alien, which basically meant that I could just always look at someone's hand. And obviously I'm going to do that every chance I get, but people started to really resent me for it. And I felt like I was being treated like, I felt like a misunderstood giant brain.
That's
because
wicked.
I was just like, listen, I'm just looking because I can.
That frees up amazing plays to do with, like, if two other players are fighting, you can just be like, look at one of their hands.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, do you want to know what he's got? Like, that's great. But I think, yeah, I don't know. RPGs are just, we're in this time now where people are doing such creative, wonderful stuff with character classes.
Yes.
But generally, those character classes all use the same template, and then you will give a character class different stats, different powers. And those different powers can be radically different. But the idea of an RPG where character classes don't even have the same stat block, don't even have the same, you know, like,
and where they kind of bleed out into the game, like out of your character sheet, is I think where you get some really fun stuff. So Mothership has a really good example, which is like every type of character has something that affects the others. So like the android is like, if you're around the android, I forget the exact mechanism, but it's like you're more likely to fail.
You get disadvantage on fear checks. Yeah. The android is just spooky. Super good.
Really, and like the marines, it's good to be around other marines it's good to be in a team. But if one marine like loses it, like it's more likely to set off everybody else because it's like the moment when you know that it's all hit the fan.
I think that's a scientist. The scientists are, the scientist is really good at not freaking out, but when the scientist freaks out, everyone else panics.
Yes.
that's a great example. But you know what? Alan Girding and Sean McCoy both came from board games. So I wonder if that's not a coincidence that they're thinking about, like, how can we, before anyone has rolled a dice or introduced their character, make a table of players look at each other and be like, I don't want to be in a room with like, well, yeah. I'm making that sound more antisocial than it is. But the idea that, you know, before you've gone, my name is Garlak and I'm an elven ranger and I don't trust strangers and I've got a pet direwolf. Before you've even got to introducing your character, you go, I'm a ranger. And players go, okay, based on your rules that are different from my rules, I already, you know, have complicated feelings about you or want to treat you differently. I think it's like the mechanical equivalent of, you know how lots of games will say during character creation, they'll have like a pick list of relationships and say, you know, I don't know, like who among this group did you once love? Or like who has seen through to your dark secret to realize you're vulnerable in the middle? The mechanical version of that, which I guess is what you're talking about with Mothership, but give me more. I'd love to see that explored more.
One place that does this really well, which is, it's a really unhelpful comment, but it's blogs, because this would be hidden away in like 100 different blogs from posts from like 8 years ago. But I definitely read a blog somewhere. You talking about a ranger reminded me of this. One of the ways that someone was musing over ideas about how do we make the ranger more interesting in like OSR style D&D. And one was sort of quite extreme in like almost giving them control of the random encounter procedure.
So I forget
the exact implementation, but it was something to do with like the ranger almost decides when random encounters happen and what they encounter, like when they're in the wilderness, which I think has a lot of room for hijinks when you mix it in with some other things as well.
That is funny, the idea that the ranger player can at any point go, stop, something's up ahead.
like these are owlbear tracks. And it's like, are you saying that because you've just decided that you want to fight an owlbear?
There's something there. Let's say they do say it's an owlbear. And then a system like that where the players can go, okay, did you just lead us to an owlbear though? Is there some reason that you wanted it to be? Because then if the player is like, I don't know, maybe your ranger wants to make some armor out of an owlbear hide.
Yeah.
Then they're like, oh, there's an owlbear up ahead. You as players in the story are going to be like, did you take us on a route where there'd be an owlbear that we all have to fight for you? I don't know.
Or maybe this is like the Jurassic Park rule where you plant the owlbear and then maybe you have an encounter with the owlbear, but you escape. And then later on, when you get a really nasty encounter, you can have the owlbear like come in like the T-Rex at the end of Jurassic Park.
Oh, save you.
So you're like, you've got some control over the wilderness, but you're not necessarily just like summoning animals to fight.
There's something here. I'm just about to start a campaign of Stonetop, and Stonetop has a lot of really nice squishy rules to do with players doing world building. But yeah, there's stuff like one of my players is basically the equivalent of a ancient historian, which is very funny with a game set in the Iron Age. But of course, that's one of the crazy things about the Iron Age. Like, the pyramids were as old to Cleopatra as Cleopatra is to us. They were older, in fact. In Stonetop, players have the ability to do world building if that's what their characters... If one of the skills is know things. And so the archaeologist is fully able to just be like, ah, yes, of course, this ruin is a graveyard. Which then I think foments distrust between the other players and the archaeologist, who's just like coming up with world building off the cuff.
But I think, there's a lot of potential in that for just making, I think, like we said, making your character feel asymmetric, because I think you're picking different character classes, you think of them as being very different. Like, you think of a D&D wizard as being completely different to a D&D fighter, but depending on the edition, they are different, but I think it could definitely be taken further.
I've been really, really taken and struck by the anime, which I've now finished, and so I'm reading the manga. Delicious in Dungeon?
Sure.
Do you know about this?
I know of it, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I thought it was just a goofy manga about, like, going into a dungeon and eating monsters, which it is. It's like half cooking manga, half, adventure story. But the woman who makes it, her interpretation of dungeons is fascinating. It's like the dungeon equivalent of hard sci-fi. Like, if there's a monster, you know, she, in her world, even if it's like a chimera, it's all classic monsters. It's a chimera, it's a harpy, it's a griffin. She has thought about the ecology of that thing. Like, she's thought about what it eats. She's thought about why do dungeons self-repopulate with monsters. And she thinks of it like an immune system. Because she has such an interesting interpretation of this stuff. It's got a great scene where the character in the party who's a thief and a halfling, like, doesn't fight because they're the trap detector. If you've got someone you pay to come with you into a dungeon to detect traps, that is what they do. They do nothing else. And it's just got really nice scenes to do with when they get to a room full of traps. That character, Chilchak, I think his name is, when the other characters are even talking or walking too fast, he starts getting really angry. Like, no, this is what I do. You're going to get yourself hurt or me hurt.
Yeah.
And it becomes a really interesting, like, and what I love about that is it, A, feels plausible. B, it really reveals to you that the wizard and the fighter and the trap detector in a dungeon aren't even playing the same game.
Sure.
Like, in if you do the absurd imaginative exercise of like, what would this be like in real life? But then why do they have the same character sheets? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think as a sort of counter example, I guess I've not played it myself, but everyone always gives shit to like Shadowrun, I think it is.
Oh, where, yeah. Like, yeah. Okay.
If you're the hacker or whatever,
you have a completely different game.
Yeah, you almost like stop the game and it's like, right, well, now I'm going to go and hack the Matrix and everyone can sit around and watch. And I think that probably is a result of that taking too long and being too disconnected from what's going on. But yeah. I can imagine a really cool game where a hacker is not even on the job. If you're doing like a cyberpunk game, the hacker is literally at home in their cellar
on the computer
but is still present like in the mission and can hack into things remotely.
100%. When I was running Delta Green a couple, like two nights ago, my party split and then one of them had some evidence that was like a video that I had to link them to watch on the internet. And I was like, how do we want to do this? And what that player told me is that watching the video, putting headphones on, and only dimly hearing the rest of the party investigate some other room or interview a suspect, that player told me that was the coolest experience of an RPG. Like, it's the equivalent of second screening an RPG. You're kind of tuned into what's happening, but you are playing your own game.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think we have only scratched the surface of, like, when I was covering board games, I always said that the thing that video game designers have to do is play more board games because there's so much to steal. Like, so much of my career is being excited about, like, not distinct genres like RPGs or board games, but the messy fusion that happens in between. I think that's where the most interesting design happens. Like, you know, there's a reason Gloomhaven is so monstrously successful, or Slay the Spire is so successful. Sure. But I think similarly, I think RPG designers could steal a bunch from board games, even though you came very close to ruining my point by pointing out that Shadowrun did exactly what I talked about.
Well, I think any idea can be done well or can be done poorly. That's the thing. Like, I think if I've not played it, so I'm not here to talk smack about Shadowrun, but that the sort of anecdote that you hear about it is it's kind of clunky. But I think the other one that leaps to mind, actually, to go to video games, I assume you've played Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes.
Oh, great game.
Where one player isn't even looking at the screen. They have the bomb disposal manual, and the other player is looking at the screen and trying to communicate to ask, how do I defuse this bomb? Like, there's a red wire and a green wire, and the number three, and the other player has to flick through the manual. I think, especially if you're playing with like one player who's not physically at the game, it could be really fun to have them literally just have a load of resources at their disposal. Like, maybe they have all the maps and all of the information about whatever job they're doing, and they're kind of there as the, like you say, almost like the person with the manual. I think there's some scope there.
Yeah, I love this. Like, you know, wizards theoretically have their noses in books and scrolls all the time, right? Like, what if, you know, you've got your fourth edition D&D style grid where the fighter and the ranger are running around and attacking, and then the wizard at the back of the group playing some sliding block puzzle or something and occasionally going, fireball! And just, like, interrupting whatever's happening to shoot a fireball across the room to, I don't know, I'm spitballing, but there's something there.
It needs to use like common charity shop puzzles, like a jigsaw, or so someone put together a jigsaw of a dog, and that's like them trying to hack into.
I swear to God, this is absurd. And also, someone is going to use this idea in 5 years and do it well, and it's going to rip. It's going to be great. I guarantee you.
Okay, so believe it or not, we were talking about Sidereal Confluence. So before we...
Yes, that's our review of Sidereal Confluence.
That's it. Yeah. Jigsaws. Yeah, cool. Well, we'll just move on. Your third choice, what have you gone for?
I've gone for what I refer to as the biggest thing in games that nobody's talking about, and certainly the biggest thing in role-playing that nobody's talking about in Europe or America. I want to talk about a game called Laboratory of Death, which is kind of a cheat because this is my opportunity to talk about Jubensha, which I just did a documentary on. So in China, role-playing dwarfs in popularity, the popularity of role-playing in the West. You simply cannot conceive of how popular role-playing is in China right now, but they do it completely differently. So the per capita equivalent is... If you think about how many escape rooms there are in the United States, there's shitloads. China per capita has three times as many what are called jubensha shops. So jubensha stands for script murder, because this evolved from murder mystery kind of stuff. The way that jubensha works in China is that there are hundreds upon hundreds of these games. You can play it online. There are TV shows of celebrities playing jubensha. What it is generally six people sit down for a game that's going to last maybe 3 hours at the low end or 2 days at the high end. And it's called script murder because you start by reading a script. And the big way that this differs from role-playing in the West is that in the West, we invent our own original characters, right? We have puzzles that are invented by the GM. Both of those things are not done in Jubensha. In Jubensha, you are given a character. You might be some discussion of like, you know, who wants to play like the rich dad? Who wants to play the dickhead daughter? And also Jubensha generally are designed for three men and three women, and the gender split in Jubensha is basically 50-50, which is wild and something in the, like, for that reason alone, we in the West should be paying more attention to it. But so you sit down with your characters, and then it's called script murder because you read a script that is your backstory for, at the low end, 10 minutes, at the high end, an hour and a half. Like, there is an unbelievable amount of information. And then the game starts. Usually, traditionally in the genre, there's been a murder, but now the genre is evolving away from that. You just start unpicking a puzzle. And everyone knows different things, and there'll be rounds where you give out what are called like evidence cards. So it's like as you search each other's rooms and houses and discover things. But the game is same as role-playing in the West. It's about inhabiting your character, solving a puzzle, and the game is a conversation. But I would really encourage people to watch my video on Jubensha on People Make Games, because I don't know, I think a lot of people find it as stunning as I did. But also because like, it's almost dispiriting that China has gone from 10 years ago having next to no role-playing experience at all. And now China's Gen Z are all quite literally crying in cafes with strangers because they're so easily able to snap into really rich and complex characters.
And yeah, so I watched the video. I'd seen it a little while ago, and I rewatched it before doing this podcast. And it's quite a difficult one to. I think you're absolutely right that people should watch the video, and I think there is a lot to learn here, and there is a lot of like. Weirdly, there's like a lot of hope for like if you're feeling like pessimistic about like the state of RPGs in the West. I think it shows that how quickly trends can move and change and something can explode out of nowhere. And kind of you know, I know that your video ends on a kind of a slight wobbly note of like optimistic, pessimistic, which is worth watching. But so for those of us who for those people who haven't seen the video, I think when I heard about this, I immediately thought of those murder mystery box sets that you can buy in Argos or whatever. And I've done a few of those over my time. I remember I think they were massive in the 90s because I've got a lot of memories of my mum and dad doing them and sitting upstairs and hearing them all act out this weird stuff downstairs. At least I hope that's what they were doing. And how would you say it differs from that kind of dinner party murder mystery that you can buy in a normal shop in the UK?
On the one hand, it's the same. Like if you really zoom out, if you squinted and you didn't care about role playing, you would say it's the same thing. I also had a lot of people from the Nordic LARP community or the LARP community say this is, I believe, what's called a parlor LARP. It's like, it's the same thing. You get a really complicated character, then walk around for 5 hours. Jubensha is much more, it's got more DNA in common with an advanced board game. Like in the West, we've seen that people who get into board games get into like really quite rich and complicated ones really quickly because you just want more complicated, more pieces, more components, more rules. That's what's happened with Jubensha. And I think the people who watch the video who said this is just a dinner party LARP. This is, you know, don't realize because, you know, it's very difficult for us to express because there's very few ones of these in the English language, how smart and componenty and bitty they are. So I said I wanted to talk about Laboratory of Death on this podcast. That's the one I've played. The structure of that was we were six, our characters were six chemistry students and our professor had just been murdered. And so it starts off, we talk about our alibis and where we were and our relationship to the professor. And then we searched one another's dorm rooms. And everyone, because there's six of us, got about seven cards, each one of which would deserve conversation. Like, I don't know, two players were in love, not in love. A guy and a girl in our player group, one of them had like, this is an example of one evidence card, a shattered photo frame with a picture of the other. So it's like, A, why did you have a photo of me? B, why was it broken? And then that leads to a very funny conversation where that player is like, I was lying. I'm going to give you a bit more of the truth, but it's still not the whole truth. And so that conversation might be 2-3 minutes of a lot of laughter. And then it's like, okay, then someone else puts down another card and it like, whoa, this changes our perspective of the story again. So it's quite systematized and structured because, you know, the game has a GM, but generally the GM doesn't speak. And so it's like, the game I played was like 3 hours of a steady drip feed of revelations, one after the other. But lots of Jubensha have, lots of them have more emphasis on role playing and feelings and romance. Romance Jubensha is a huge part of it. And like, I don't know, it's just such an interesting counterpart to, we have lots of stories sorts of TTRPGs that do stories of love and romance in the West, right? But those stories will have a loose bit of structure, but it'll be like, make your characters, create a setting. And then, you know, we've got a series of systems that are going to test that relationship. What Jubensha can do is they have written down, like in pre-creating character notes to the sentence. Like, I don't know, for the TTRPG designers listening to this, imagine rather than creating a game to simulate romance, imagine creating six characters that you could only play once, and then playtesting that so that the revelations about each other come out like, I don't know, like a dripping tap. Sure. Until by the end, everybody is weeping.
So I think for the way that it sounded to me from watching the video and from hearing you speak then is, would you say it's almost like the comparison between a conversation I'm sure you've had a million times, which is when you say that you like board games, people say, oh, like Monopoly. And then you kind of have to find a way to tactfully say, yeah, but not shit. Like really well designed, but following the same kind of structure. Like it sounds like they're just more intricately designed than those. I've had good evenings playing those murder mystery parties, but I don't remember much about the mystery or the game. I just remember speaking in a funny voice with some friends.
I hear you. I don't want to do the designers of Western murder mystery games dirty, because the main thing they have to struggle against is audience literacy. Sure. Like, you know, people, most, if not all, murder mystery games that are designed in the UK as products or fun team building exercises have to assume that your players have never done this before. Yeah. The difference with Jubentia is that Jubentia audience, like there are entry level Jubentia games, which, to be quite honest, do actually require more reading than you would ever get a Western audience to do. But Western geeks would do it for sure.
Yeah.
Like I would do it. Great. But then the reason Jubentia has become so ludicrously advanced and impressive, and we desperately need to study it and learn about it more in the West, is that China's Gen Z got hooked. So if you play it and imagine imagine the most high-end complicated murder mystery game you can imagine playing, right? Then imagine you said, wow, that's so fun. Hey, let's us and all of our friends do another one next week. But it has to be more complicated.
Yeah.
And then imagine doing that for 3 years. Like the upper end is just farcical. Quite literally, imagine reading for 2 hours, which is like a novella, before you start playing. I don't know. I think really we have plenty of talented murder designers in the West, and like the game that first sort of at least partially inspired the Jubentia movement in China was actually a French game called Death Wears White, which is still available for purchase and would be a great thing for people to buy if they want to explore the scene. But it's not that our games are shit. It's just that it's a craze in China. And for something being a craze, it means the design gets really advanced very quickly.
Well, I think if you look at something like even, I'm trying to think of a mainstream, I mean, let's say Gloomhaven. Think of Gloomhaven as like, is it, you know, arguably one of the most successful board games of all time? I think if you laid that out in front of somebody like 30 years ago who had just come off playing HeroQuest or something, it would be like, what is this? Like, this is never going to take off. This is too complicated. But it's about building that literacy. Well, not literally literacy, but just the literacy with the form. And it's obviously built up as a gradual thing in China. And it's again, the thing that really leapt out at me is it's really optimistic to see how you can see a form of game that looks like, oh, it couldn't possibly work over here, almost in some ways. Yeah. But you know, it could, and who knows what the next version of that is going to be that's going to explode, and to what sort of levels it's going to go.
Yeah, that I think that's really the thing I take away from the story, that I find it enlightening, like heartening and depressing in equal measure, because like, I don't know, I'm gonna sound like the biggest weeb right now, but there is something about the East Asian tolerance for game design that we don't have in, especially at least here in the UK, that is monumentally depressing. Like, I don't know. I'm kind of interested to how well The Genius does, because when The Genius, the South Korean TV show, came out, 15 years ago, I had never seen such advanced game design on a TV show. And we're just about to get the UK version of The Genius now, presented by David Tennant. And I will be interested, because like the fact that the UK audience has popped off for The Traitors, which is just this really weird simplified version of Werewolf.
So many angry Werewolf players about The Traitors.
I can't conceive of it. I'm the person who pushed Blood on the Clock Tower to the Werewolf community. I was one of the annoyed like Werewolf players when The Traitors did really well. But I think it'll be interesting to see whether The Genius sticks in the UK.
Yes.
And I don't know, like, I really don't want to say anything problematic here, but I think it's really interesting that murder mystery dinner parties were invented in the UK and have only ever stayed at that level of complexity for like 30 or 40 years. Mm. And then murder mysteries arrive in China. They have a couple of TV shows about, you know, that demonstrate the murder mystery format. And then they've gone more, bigger, more complicated, more emotions. We all want to be crying at the end of this game. Come on, that's why we're here. And like, I don't know if the UK audience could ever do that. And then answering why is a question that would drive me crazy.
Well, I think, so when I heard about this and when I watched the video, I had too many thoughts to possibly put in this podcast, and I didn't want to talk all over yours, but I did note down a few
bullet points. I've been talking for a long time. I would love for you to talk.
Well, I think the thing that leapt out to me, and this is something I've always thought about murder mystery dinner party things, is the very fact that I know so many people who have at least done a murder mystery box set at some point. Even if they've just done one or two, I know lots of people who've tried it out, but I know much fewer people from like daily life who have tried an RPG. And I think there's something in that structure of, oh, on Saturday night, I'm running a murder mystery. Do you want to come over and we'll have dinner and we'll do this silly murder mystery game? And it's a very structured social thing that I think is very accessible in a way that it's not if I say, oh, do you want to come and play an RPG? Because it's that feels a bit broader and a bit vaguer and people don't know what that means. So I think for everyone who sort of finds it difficult to get together an RPG group, I think that kind of box game format, I feel like there's something in that. And I know that I'm kind of just describing a one shot, but I think having it almost, I'm not sure what my point is. I think
there's something in the, I think depressingly, the dinner is the part of it.
Yes, that's what I was trying to say, yeah.
Yeah, like if you're inviting people over for dinner and there's a game, that's a noble British tradition. If you're inviting people over for a game, that sounds weird and like something a mainland European would do.
Yeah, so we need some way to trick people into your house.
I think escape rooms have shown that we...
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, escape rooms did pop off in the West before they popped off in China or East Asia, I think. So that shows that we will go out and do experiential fun.
So we need a way to work the meal into the RPG.
Maybe. Or so. We need people to think... I don't know. Is it... Well, I think the thing that it's so annoying, the whole thing drives me nuts. Like, so in the West, something I've come up with again and again, especially when I was a board game reviewer, is that our audiences generally don't want to be embarrassed in public. They don't want to have to learn anything. They don't want to have to do something new. That is something you really struggle with a UK or an American audience. Then China, when I was speaking to people who were like knew about the Juventus scene, they said, oh yeah, that was absolutely true to begin with. Like when Juventus started, everyone was really embarrassed about acting or having feelings in front of strangers or inhabiting a role. But then, you know, the games were so good, we just got over it. And now people like voluntarily act and cry in front of strangers all the time. And I'm like, God damn it. Why didn't that? Why hasn't that happened over here? Why are we still so deeply ashamed and so wary about playing a new game?
Well, I think seeing someone on TV do it normalizes it a lot. So I think over here, I think after the Traitors, I would have no trouble now asking people who have never played an RPG to come and say, oh, let's play Werewolf. It's like the Traitors. And I think with RPGs, you obviously saw that with like, it's not quite television, but Critical Role normalizes it a lot. And I'm gonna say a nice thing now. I got a lot of my friends into board games by showing them the very early Shut Up and Sit Down videos that showed two charismatic guys showing a nice board game off and talking about it in a way that was funny and made it feel very approachable and not this super niche weird thing. So I think having that kind of grounding and letting someone see someone else do the thing first and it looking kind of normal is a big factor.
Yeah, I agree. And the Juventus did pop up in China after a smash hit TV show called Who's the Murderer, which was a dynamite hit. Everyone watched it. So Juventus shops really started as like, hey, who wants to play Who's the Murderer for real? So maybe if we bring Who's the Murderer, maybe that's it. That's how we get Juventus in the West. We export Who's the Murderer to the West, and then we start getting Who's the Murderer pop-up venues, and then we're off to the races.
Have you got any contacts at the BBC?
No. I... No, I don't. YouTube means that I am successful, but deeply unconnected, except among cool TTRPG designers such as yourself.
Oh, of course. The other thing that I had on my list of notes to quickly round this one off is the thing that really interests me about it is the other thing that jumps out at me is the fact that there's a GM, which you don't generally get in a murder mystery thing. And you don't get in most social deduction games, except stuff like Blood on the Clock Tower. And I wondered, do you think, is the, so the relationship with of the G, the role of the GM in the Tubentia games is something I was struggling to kind of get to grips with. Sure. Does it feel like, this sounds like a very loaded question, but does it feel like the GM brings a lot to it in the way that a good or a poor GM can kind of make or break an RPG? Or does it feel more like it's a GM role, like if you're GMing Werewolf, where it's almost more like a formality and you're just going through the process?
It depends on the game you are playing. With games that are really like just puzzly, or what are called mechanism Jubentia, where they bring in a lot of elements of board games, so you are playing a role. But like my favorite example of this was you all play merchants in a market and you are trying to solve a mystery, but also you want to end up with the most money at the end of the game. Oh, so it's about bribing other players for information. With those, the GM can be compared to the host of an escape room where they are watching you. If you start pulling something off the walls or you're going in the wrong direction, they can be like, no, 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 don't do that. Also, they're there for like, because this is a puzzle, but it is also a story. Like if you have a card that's like, you know, there are no windows on the second story, you might go up to the GM and be like, could somebody jump up from the first story and climb through the windows? And the GM might be like, no. And you just, that's, it's like a helpful thing. However, some of the, I was told that if you're playing a horror Jubentia or a romance Jubentia where atmosphere is a big part of it, then it's much more comparable to a GM of an RPG where you walk in into a horror game, you have to set the tone by being the spooky butler. You have to creep everybody out. Jump scares from the GM were a big part of horror Jubentia that I found. One of the rooms I was watching had like, it was a room in a Jubentia cafe that was specifically for horror games. And it had like little holes in the wall so the GM could spook you out after you hadn't seen them for 20 minutes by sticking their head through the wall and going, ah! So that's obviously awesome. Yeah. But yeah, it's exactly halfway between running an escape room and being the GM of an RPG, I think.
Because I think there's another bit of sort of slightly underexplored design space. I played my first miniatures war game that involved a GM last year.
Did you?
And I know this is like a thing that goes all the way back to the dawn of like miniature war games.
Yeah,
and,
of course, historical
stuff. But it's kind of like if you grew up with like Warhammer and stuff, there was never a GM there. It was just like one versus one or two versus two. And I was surprised how it was only a very short, quick game, but I was amazed how much it brought to it because the GM could like slip us little secret messages from command halfway through the battle, or they could change the scenario. If it felt like it was stalling, they could like just make an event happen. And I'm really interested in, yeah, bringing a GM into other types of game. Board games. Like, I mean, you've played a lot of board games. How many board games can you think of, just to put you on the spot, other than Blood on the Clock Tower, where there is a formal GM role?
You know, I want to say basically none, but there are some games where you have like an asymmetrical role where, no, that's not your question. I was going to talk about, I was going to get distracted and be nerdy. however, something I did end up really enjoying at various points in my board game career is teaching a game and then just running it for people and watching them enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like, which is like, then you're halfway between a GM who's like keeping the game moving and describing cool things that have happened, but you're also just a game show host at that point.
Yeah.
You're reminding people of the rules and the structure and keeping everything moving, keeping everything on the rails. If anything, actually, you're closer to a Jubentia host where you're just there to introduce the game, create some atmosphere, and answer rules queries.
Yeah. And I mean, most games have that. If you're the person that's brought the game to the table and you've got to like, you're still a player, but the amount of times I've taught a game and I thought, well, I'm going to play not 100% here because I don't want to just crush people. And really? I'm going to just try and make some cool things happen. So yeah, it's kind of like a de facto GM role, I guess.
Yeah, but honestly, like if people haven't tried it, running board games and not playing as the GM, I find super satisfying.
Yeah.
I think it's just, I don't know. Returning to my like the point that I made half an hour ago, like I'm really just interested in the space between established roles. So like I have never heard actually of a modern miniatures war game that involves a GM. And immediately I'm like, damn, what can you do with that? That sounds mint. That sounds absolutely great. And I think like in having, if bringing Juventure over and having it as another reference point, what does a Juventure GM do? What does a Juventure mystery look like? What does a Juventure romance look like? That gives us more reference points to A, enjoy, and B, figure out like, what is halfway between a Juventure romance game and a romance TTRPG?
Hmm.
And I think that just opens up more design space for us.
Yeah, definitely. And the miniatures thing I can really recommend as well, because the other thing that's really nice is as a player, you don't have to really think that much about the rules because there is someone whose job that is.
Exactly.
So I knew how to play the game by the end of it, but we kind of started playing and the ref was just like, oh yeah, I'll just, you know, I'll explain the rules as you go. Here's a couple of things you need to know about your units. And if we reached a point where I was like, well, what does it mean that I'm behind cover? They would know, oh, it's +2 to whatever.
Would they, like a GM in a TTRPG, occasionally ignore a rule if it didn't make a sense?
I am sure that they did. There was definitely a bit of a curtain up where we were like not 100% aware of the rules, which I quite like a lot of the time. But it never felt unfair. And I think again, it helps that we were both the players were on board. We weren't like playing it super competitively. We were playing it to try out this new game and sort of have a fun battle, really. So yeah, I think there's a lot of to do there. The last thing I'm going to do, because I know that if I don't mention this, someone will tell me that I should have mentioned it. You've spoken a bit about how the power of having those pre-made characters that are kind of set up in a pre-made scenario. Have you played or read Lady Blackbird by John Harper?
No, I am. Oh, is it John Harper? No, I'm very aware of it and its role in the RPG community and its design. I have not read it or played it.
I'm not going to like gush about it now, but I think it's worth checking out. That's one that has kind of a set list of characters that have established relationships to each other, and you always play with that group of characters. And that's got some of the themes in there that are kind of worth checking out.
Why do you think, as a pro TTRPG guy, that there aren't more games that do that? There aren't more games that are just like this.
Yeah, well, you spoke about Silent Titans on Yoko's podcast.
Oh, right.
And that has a bit of that because the pre-made characters that you generate are kind of all ready to go.
And weirdly specific. Kind of
yeah.
You're a cow with an Enfield rifle. Yeah.
Yeah, I like it a lot. And I have thought before about just having like a bank of here's 100 preset characters that you can kind of roll on. I think I probably don't have the. I think for the games I make, I like to have a little bit more options for like replayability so that you can pick different characters each time. But if I was making like a smaller game, I think having that just tier of 6 characters that connect to each other is really powerful. And I'm not sure why.
Wait, hang on. Can we not? But surely Electric Bastion Land is that. Like,
well,
you know.
So I've kind of gone, I've gone on like a sliding scale of it. I'm going to get self-indulgent now and just talk about what I've done. So with Into the Yard, I deliberately had it so that your starting character is just a starting package of items. So the example I always use is that you might start with like some shackles and like a club.
Great.
And so it could be like, well, am I like an escaped prisoner, or am I like a bounty hunter, or did I just like kill someone and take these things? So it's more of a spark to get you going. And then with Electric Bastion Land, you have an actual failed career. So your failed career might be, oh yeah, you were a bounty hunter and here's why you have these items. And I thought, well, I'm kind of
doing the classes in Electric Bastion Land dirty, as if bounty hunter is the like, you know, general default and not totally insane, like wonderfully.
There is some kind of bounty hunter. What is it? There's like a polar bounty hunter who goes out into the frozen north where reality is kind of breaking down. But yeah, they're usually a little bit more interesting than that. And then with Mythic Bastion Land, it's a bit more specific still in that you are like a particular type of knight and you are like the... I don't know, I can't think of an example now off the top of my head. The silver knight or whatever, and you have a power related to that. And it's still like left open as to who specifically you are as a person, but you are that knight. And I think, yeah, maybe the next thing I do is just going to be, it feels like I'm going in that direction. So maybe the next one I do will just be like a list of 100 fully fleshed out characters. And yeah, I think it's for people coming in, people coming into RPGs, it can be daunting to give them that blank character sheet. And some players will just kind of almost shut down and not develop their character at all.
Yeah.
Which isn't always a bad thing if that's not what they're here for. But I think if you have a character who at least has a name and a few character traits, that's often enough to kind of just push them into embracing that side of the game a bit more.
Yeah, I do hear you. I, however, think the if you look at it for an individual player, would you rather have an idea for a character or have a fully fleshed out person? You know, probably being given some wiggle room is fun. But as we see in Lady Blackbird and Jubentia, when you're given a specific character, what's great is that specific character can be designed to bounce off four other super specific characters.
Yeah.
At the table the characters that are like a perfect harmony, like a sitcom cast, really.
Sure.
Like one of you is, yeah.
I guess a good kind of middle ground there is something like Mothership, where the character classes kind of have innate relationships built in. So like there is a relationship between androids and scientists. It's mechanical, but it kind of infers a relationship as well. So yeah, that perhaps is a nice little middle ground there. Okay, so any closing thoughts on Jubentia before we wrap this up?
No. You've exhausted my brain. I'm going to go have a bath. I'll tell you, like, I don't know. I'm so happy to just be in role-playing games as a career shift. It's such a nice space to be in. I'm just a happy guy, Chris.
We're happy to have you. And I got a little pang of when you were on, I think it was when you were on Yochai's podcast, maybe. You were talking about, I heard you say the phrase, rulings, not rules. And
is that you?
My heart's no, it's not me. I should have claimed that I made that up. No, but that's like the OSR line from like I'm gonna say that Matt Finch wrote that in the OSR primer or primer for old school play, whatever it's called.
Is that the famous like
that was
document?
One of the many Bibles that have been written.
God. Okay.
And yeah, it was kind of a primer for like OSR play that was at one point people largely accepted it as kind of like this is some kind of unified vision.
Yeah, I've got you were so helpful in giving me an OSR document when I was starting Quinn's Quest and being like, I'm really trying to get to the bottom of this. I have to be honest, having read, you know, like most, if not all of the books on the list that you gave me, I still don't fully, like if someone asked me what's the OSR, I would just say, oh, don't get it. Like all I can do is explain what it stands for and some maybe general vibes. And then I just give
it. And it's not always clear what it stands for.
I thought we were committed to revival, right?
I like Renaissance.
Oh, fuck. God damn it.
I like Renaissance. Well, let's not go into this, but I'm nailing my flag to the Renaissance mast. But yeah, that's Jubentia. Okay, so thank you for sharing your choices with us. Just to have a look at the three, I just wanted to very quickly see if there was anything that you think connects these three that tells us about who you are.
Oh, interesting. I think really, I talk about what we've got? We've got Torchbearer, we've got Sidereal Confluence, we've got Jubentia. You might think there's no connection, but I think there is. Because in my career, I started off covering video games, right? And then I decided I wanted to, rather than, you know, be playing with these like, you know, fictive digital constructions, which are great. Video games are good. I'm not arguing that. I just wanted to be closer to people. So I got into board games and then I was sat around the table with people, right? And then I decided I wanted to be even closer to people. And now I'm working in TTRPGs where you're still sat around the table with people, but you're not looking down at the table. You're looking up into the eyes of your friends. So I think generally my career has just only ever seen me pushing more and more towards human beings. And humans and emotionality and the human experience. And I think that's what these three games have in common. Because Torchbearer takes dungeons, which are such a key part of RPGs, and then says, okay, but let's think about what it's like to be a human going under the ground. Sidereal Confluence is a board game that says, you know, like, this is just, we're going to have the most complicated game, but it's all in service of you looking at your friends in the eyes and having just the most insane conversations. And then Jubentia is a school of role-playing, which I think is, I don't know, I might even argue that it's certainly some Jubentia games are doing the most in the entire global role-playing community to enable humans to have really emotional experiences.
Nice. And I think when I was looking at the three of them, I think they all feel like games that I would, that if someone was telling me about them, they would have like that story they always tell about it. In Sidereal Confluence is like the story of and not necessarily even related to the mechanics, not saying like, oh yeah, I unlocked this bonus where I got +2 to this and +3 to that and they combined and it was great. It creates these moments of conversation, I guess, whether it's like the wheeling and dealing of Sidereal Confluence, or like the fear of Torchbearer and getting into your character, and then Juventus obviously being this hyper social kind of experience and heavily kind of lots of twists and stuff.
I think that's great as well. Yeah, and shorter, which is better.
Yeah, and I think for me, the games that, you know, it's easy to look at some of the games that I've written and the games that I like and think, oh, well, they don't really directly engage with story so much. Like, but that's because the kind of stories that I like that come out of games are the ones that come apart. They come out of the game almost as a side effect.
Yeah.
Like, there's,
and then that makes them more fully yours as well.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think that's a really powerful thing.
When am I going to get a PDF of Mythic Bastion Land, by the way?
You can have a PDF right now with a load of gaps where the artwork's going to be.
Oh, I mean, I'll take that for sure. If you want to send that to me, that'll be my afternoon reading. That'd be wicked.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I'll send you that. But you'll definitely be getting a copy when it's finished. Yeah, I'll send you the. I don't know why I've stumbled over this so much. We'll edit this out. But yeah,
I wanted to plug your game on your podcast. But
sure. Oh, no, I'll just like cut the words together for you saying like when you're gushing about one of the other games, I'll just plug.
Oh,
plug
it, I'll plug the it word, into the
section. The bit you said about doing the most for RPGs in the world, I'll just put it here.
It's Mythic Bastion. It had to be. Always.
Yeah. So thanks for sharing your choices with us. Where can people find out more about your stuff?
Please, everybody, if you have not yet subscribed or tried, sampled the flavors of the new YouTube channel, Quinn's Quest, please search for that because I am doing my best to, I don't know, I'm giving it all I've got. I've been a games journalist for 20 years, and this is probably the most, it's one of the most exciting things I've ever done. The games, and really it's just... The games are great. The games are so good. And I'm really looking forward to telling you and giving just like a really exhaustive, heartfelt, funny review that's long and features me having played the game of a new big RPG every month.
I think if you don't watch RPG stuff on YouTube, I think watch it, because for me, this sounds like a plug and you can pay me later if you want for this. But I think it feels very, very different in a good way to a lot of other RPG stuff. And there's really very few channels where I'm like eager for the next episode, but I am like genuinely eager to see what the next episode is.
That's super kind.
I think it's doing something very different I'm sorry to keep going back to this, in the same way that I felt like when I watched Early Shut Up and Sit Down, and I was like, yeah, this feels very different to other game reviews like this.
No, it's totally the same thing. With Early Shut Up, the RPG community feels like in a very similar space right now that Shut Up and Sit Down did in 2011, where we were, in 2011, we were like, damn, these board games are good as hell, and no one's talking about them. And the standard of reviews we didn't think was up to snuff. And I think RPGs are in a similar space where the games are amazing. And I don't blame RPG reviewers for not producing the kind of content that I want to consume yet, because there's no money in it. But I'm very privileged. I have a platform. I'm able to make a bit of money. And so in doing so, I'm able to hopefully raise the standard of reviews and discourse around RPGs. Or as I like to call it, give the RPGs the reviews they deserve, because they deserve fucking great reviews because they're great games.
Lovely. Although it is going to get harder if you do, like you've said, if you meet everybody in the RPG community.
It already sucks. I did not, you know, when I was on Yokai's podcast, I didn't realize that Ken was his game. I just fully forgot.
Yeah. And everyone will hear every review. I'm not trying to put you off. Every creator will be watching every review that you do. I mean, because it's just such a small village feel. I think it's a good thing, but it's also probably best to not think about
it too. I've got my first negative review in a couple months.
I thought you hadn't got Mythic Bastion Land yet.
Oh, the fun we have. This has been really great, Chris. I really enjoyed my appearance on this podcast.
Well, thank you for joining me. And if you are listening still, you can join me here next week, where I'll be welcoming another guest to distill their gaming history into the Rule of Three. Goodbye for now.
Take care.